At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger, and you can get started now by saving when you join today. We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need, and you can work out your way on your time at any convenient location near you. Most open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save. Just $1 down, $15 a month. See Home Club for details.
And it is the most incredible chimpanzee imitation I have ever seen in my life. He wears.
How many have you seen?
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dyson.
You know, mister, you, if you think you can take that truck of yours and just use it as a murder weapon, just killing people on the highway, well, you're wrong. You've got another thing coming.
You need help.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Wreckatopia, episode 149. I'm Chris Atkinson, joined by Jeremy Scott.
Hello, everybody.
And we are also joined by Aaron Dicer.
Hidely ho, Maximum Overdrive Arenos.
Ooh, Maximum Overdrive. Making the show. Also making the show is chat. We'd like to welcome them for coming out here and watching us talk about movies on a Tuesday. Appreciate you guys coming out. And we'll get on to the small recommends.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
And I will start us off with a movie that was nominated for some Oscars. It's called Anora, new Sean Baker movie. It is about a woman who is a sex worker who works at a strip club and meets a Russian oligarch's son. And the Russian oligarch's son pays for her to be around for like a week or two or something like that, and introduces her into this world of partying and fun and everything. And then looks like they're having a grand old time, and he asks her to marry him, and then they go to Vegas and do that. But there's a problem. The Russian oligarchs, the father and mother, don't want this marriage to happen because Anora is not to their station. And the whole rest of the movie is basically trying to find him when he runs away. I have not given this movie any justice with its synopsis, but I want you to guys to kind of like experience this on your own, because I didn't really know much about this movie going in. Only knew that Mikey Madison was in there, and you know, I'd seen her in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Scream. She's been nominated for an Oscar. I think it's a well-deserved nomination. And this new guy who plays, and this is what's funny about this movie, is that when the Oscar nominations came out, I thought that the Oscars were being lazy and they were just nominating the other co-lead in this movie. And he's good. He's totally great. But there's another guy in this that Anora strikes up a friendship or weird kind of relationship with during the movie, and it's really the heart and soul of that movie. And I was just sitting there going, man, I could spend another hour with these two, that it's so good. But the guy's name is Yura Borisov, who plays Igor.
Yura Borisov.
What's that?
Sorry, I said you're a Borisov.
You take that back. Anyway, I really, really enjoyed Anora. I think this is another movie that fits in that Sean Baker world. I know that's not for everybody, but I think even if you didn't like something like Red Rocket, you're going to like this movie.
Man, I don't know what to do with this guy, because I love The Florida Project and I hated Red Rocket. Mm. So I guess I'll watch this and probably fall right in the middle.
I don't know. I think you might really enjoy this. This is a movie that while there's a lot of seriousness to it, they find humor in all sorts of different ways, and I think it's great.
It's my favorite Sean Baker movie, which isn't saying a ton for me. I don't usually, like, we're not on the same wavelength necessarily. I didn't like The Florida Project that much, really didn't like Red Rocket. But this is funny. This movie, in my opinion, is a comedy that has those things to say that Sean Baker has been saying in his other movies, and I think less elegant ways for me personally. Mm-hmm. He says it in a more elegant way here. And I don't know. I think it's really good. The performances are great. I think it wanders a little bit, gets a little bit messy, but it's still my favorite Sean Baker. So, yeah, it's worth a watch for sure. Hmm. Yep.
Jeremy, what do you got?
All right. I watched a movie from 1991 that I had maybe faintly heard of called Mississippi Massault.
Oh, yeah.
And this is Denzel Washington. Now, he's already done, I wanted to clarify, of course, he's already done St. Elsewhere. That was what sort of made him a star. But movie-wise, he's done The Mighty Quinn and Glory and Mo Better Blues. But he hasn't yet done Ricochet, Malcolm X, Much Ado About Nothing, Pelican Brief. So this is right in the middle of that. He's not even the main focus here, though he is generally going to be on the poster whenever you see it. This is actually accidentally timely. This is about a family of South Asians, Indians, who are living in Uganda in the 70s. And a real event that happened in the world was the expulsion of Asians from Uganda in 1972. And so the movie shows this family being one of the families expelled from the country of Uganda. They briefly spend a little bit of time in England, and then they end up in Mississippi, where they have relatives who own, I think, hotels or something. And so basically this movie is about a displaced family trying to find its place in the world. And the father has a really hard time adjusting to anything American. The daughter embraces it, instantly has a bunch of friends, falls in love with Denzel, which makes the dad angry because the dad has issues with black people because of what happened in Uganda to his family. And the movie is really just about how they all sort of cope with being plopped into this new land and situation. I found it really, really interesting and fascinating and unfortunately timely, given what's going on. And Denzel is always great. He's fantastic in this. Again, he's not the main character. The family of South Asian Indians are the main focus here. But it was really good, really solid. I really enjoyed it. So there you go. Check it out.
I've never seen this, but for some reason I have a really good memory of seeing this poster one day, like at a movie theater. I don't know why. I don't know why that memory sticks with me so much, but I've still never seen this movie. So I'm glad to hear that it's good.
I threw it on yesterday since I knew you were small wrecking it today. So I did watch it, and it's really good. I think it allows us a perspective on race relations that as Americans, I guess I should say, that we don't often think about because we get caught up in the, forgive the pun, black and white of it all. Like everything's black and white, you know, as far as racism in America. It can seem predominantly that way. And because this is about two different cultures that aren't American Caucasian primarily in this movie, you see race relations through this different lens that I think is really valuable for empathy and for understanding and all of those things. And you see it in several different contexts. You see it in the Ugandan context. You see it in, you know, the American context. You see it in the black community context, the Indian community context. Like, there's all these different avenues towards empathy in this movie. It's definitely a worthwhile watch. And of course, Denzel's great. So, yeah.
All right. Aaron, what do you got for us?
I'm going to recommend a movie called The Square. This is Ruben Östlund. And if you don't know that name, he first came into my radar with Force Majeure, which I think is an incredible movie. Really loved it. He has a way of tapping into some elements of humanness that I find really interesting and intriguing. He's got a little quirkiness to him, and this movie is no different. Most recently, you know him from The Triangle of Sadness that went on awards run recently, and that movie is very much the same. The Square, I feel like, kind of gets lost in that threesome of movies of his and is a really interesting watch. I think I could say with all of his movies, even if you don't end up liking them, most people find them interesting and are glad they experienced them. And this one is no different. I'll just highlight one scene that kind of emphasizes the kind of the themes of this movie. But it is about an art collector who is kind of in, you know, art society and then trying to deal with the ideas of using art to talk about the separation of classes, you know, classism, those kind of things. And the movie deals with questions like, can you do that when you're rich? Like, are you able to even, you know, appropriately find art that expresses that? The one scene I wanted to talk about, if you're watching this, the picture is that scene. There is a man in this movie who imitates a chimpanzee. And it is the most incredible chimpanzee imitation I have ever seen in my life. He wears.
How many have you seen?
I've seen plenty of people try to imitate monkeys. I've seen Andy Serkis do Planet of the Apes movies. He's good. Whoa. Like there are reference points here, but this man is good in not just a way of impersonation, but actually a way of like encompassing how a chimpanzee would act in this situation. So he comes into this room of all these finely dressed people at this banquet, and it's supposed to be this art piece or whatever. And he is just as if you let an actual chimpanzee out into this room. And so all of these people are trying to process, wait, this is art. Is this funny? Is this cool? Is he going to kill me? You know, like there's like all this stuff is going on, and the subtext there is really, really interesting. The movie is worth it for this scene alone, but I think overall the movie has some really incredible moments. I guess I could tell you the setup is he gets his wallet stolen and he gets pickpocketed, and he knows because his phone was stolen too what apartment building it's in. So he writes a threatening letter and puts it in every single apartment in that apartment building. And then so it's kind of the ramifications of making that choice. Interesting movie.
How does he go from that to chimpanzee?
Well, it's again the movie because this is like a banquet for his museum or his, you know, art collection or whatever. So if you know, Ruben Östlund movies go all over the place. Like they're, you know, that's one of the things he does to explore the, you know, the ideas that he's dealing with or whatever. But yeah. It's interesting stuff.
All right.
I should mention Elizabeth Moss is in it, Dominic West shows up too. So there are a few faces you might know as well.
Yeah. Well,
go ahead, Chris.
No, that picture alone makes me want to see this movie. So anyway,
that it is a very compelling picture. I give you that. I just want to point out you have never seen me do a chimpanzee imitation.
That's fair. Are you going to do it now?
I just want that on the record. No.
Okay. I'm just checking.
No further questions, Your Honor.
Oh my goodness. Okay. On to our big recommend.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Which is Duel from 1971, and this one was mine, so I will take it away. Duel is a made-for-TV movie that aired on ABC in November of 1971, directed by Steven Spielberg from a screenplay by Richard Matheson based on a story he had published in Playboy after he had an incident with a big rig in 1963. David Mann, played by Dennis Weaver, is driving his car on a lonely highway in the western United States to do some business. On the way, he listens to the radio and a man talking about his embarrassment at not being the true head of the family because his wife is. As David is about to find out, he's going to be in a similar predicament concerning manhood when he encounters a slowly moving truck that says flammable. This seems like a normal, everyday occurrence, and David does what everyone would do in this situation, find a good time to pass the truck and move on with his life. But then, moments later, the big truck zooms past David and then slows down to a crawl again once he gets in front. David soon passes again and gets a rude honk from this truck as he goes by. David makes his first stop of the trip at a gas station where the big truck also stops. The driver never makes an appearance, but David notices some dirty brown boots under the truck on the passenger side while his car is being serviced. After refusing a new radiator hose, the serviceman says, "You're the boss," and David says, "Not in my house, I'm not." Not long after, he's on the phone with his wife, and we find out there was an incident where a man named Steve Henderson made an aggressive move on his wife, and the fact that he did nothing is still a bit of a sore spot between them. Ultimately, his wife tells him he needs to hurry up his business and get home soon. After leaving the station, the big truck catches up to David, and he's back into a conflict that he never thought would continue. Once again, the truck passes and slows down in front of him. This time, when David tries to pass, the truck merges over into the other lane to prevent it. Eventually, the mysterious asshole driver waves him to pass, but when he gets into the passing lane, he is greeted by a car driving the other way, and it nearly causes a collision. Eventually, David sees an opening on the side of the road that will allow an off-road pass, and he leaves the truck in the distance. Problem solved, movie over. Psych! The truck comes barreling down the street at David again. This time, he figures just increasing his speed to dangerous levels will help him leave this truck in the dust, but the truck seems to be supercharged in some way and keeps up. During this exchange, the truck actually makes bumper-to-bumper contact with him. At an alleged speed of nearly 100 miles an hour, David finally pulls off the road near a cafe as the truck speeds by. At the Labyrinthian Cafe, David goes to the bathroom, but when he returns, he sees the devil truck parked outside, which means nearly anyone in the diner could be the dickhead who's been trying to run him off the road. It also seems that every diner is compelled to take a look at him over their shoulder in a suspicious manner. David tries to identify the driver by their boots, but nearly everyone is wearing similar boots. He orders some food. We are taken into David's inner monologue as he tries to figure out why this situation is happening and what he needs to do next. And he even hopes that the truck driver may only be here because it's the only place to eat for miles, and maybe this situation is over. But what if it's not? How does he escape? Can he call the police about a situation that's impossible to prove? Does he try to identify the correct person and reason with the unreasonable? David thinks he identifies the driver and tries to tell him to knock it off, but the man he accosts clearly has no idea what he's talking about. David gets so frustrated with him that he knocks his sandwich out of his hands and receives a beating for it, which tells you you should never try to sleuth your way out of a cafe.
Mm-hmm.
To make things even worse, the evil truck starts driving off and David never sees who the driver was, and they don't appear to have even been in the cafe. He gets back into his car, and that's where he runs into a bus that's stuck on the side of the road. He's a good person, so he stops, and the bus driver requests a push. Unfortunately, David's car is not the kind of vehicle that can make that happen, and for his efforts, he gets a bunch of laughing children in his face. Then, the thing that's been challenging his manhood the whole movie shows up in the distance. David is concerned that the truck may try to hurt the kids, but when it arrives, it adds even more insult by coming by and helping the bus driver get his bus unstuck. And by the way they transition that, you could always think that maybe he did end up pushing that bus off a cliff later on. You never know. It's could have been some awful tragedy going on that we'd never see. David uses this opportunity to get the hell out of there, but like always, the truck catches up. This time it catches up next to a railroad track with a passing train, and the truck tries to push David into it. At the last minute, the truck pushes David into the railroad tracks, but just after the train has passed. His car gets pushed off-road, and once again, the truck drives on. And this apparently was footage that Spielberg shot after the movie had aired on TV so that he could get a theatrical release overseas, because 90 minutes was the magic number. It was a 71-minute movie or 79-minute movie, and then he did this, and it was able to get a theatrical release worldwide or whatever. But as expected, David catches up to the slow-moving truck, and we're back to square one. David tries a passive approach and stops by another station where he looks to use a telephone. This station also has a bunch of snakes. Why did it have to be snakes? David goes to a payphone and asks for the police. As he does so, the truck comes back to the station, attempts to smash into him while he's in the booth. It also breaks some rattlesnakes and tarantulas free in the process. The truck makes a couple of rounds to try to kill David before he gets back into his car and we're back to the chase. This time he finds a spot to hide, again next to some railroad tracks, as the truck drives past. David falls asleep and is awakened by the truck. No, it's just a train. And Spielberg playing with the audience by putting the truck sound in to scare David to death. It's been an hour, so David thinks it's been long enough that the truck will have long gone by this point. But because there's still 25 minutes left in the movie, of course the truck has been waiting for him. And David screeches to a halt across the road, where for the first time in this movie, another car out of nowhere shows up and nearly crashes into David. But that's probably because this guy is also an asshole. A cat and mouse game ensues where David tries to drive super fast past the idle truck, but the truck speeds up and drives before he can make any headway. Another standoff, and David gets out of the car, clearly ready to confront the person inside. The truck drives away again. Another car comes by, driven by a couple that will one day show up in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. They refuse to help David, and then everyone notices the truck coming down the road in reverse. The couple gets the hell out of there, and David tries to take refuge. The truck doesn't smash David's car because that would be unsporting. David gets back into his car and gets a mocking go-ahead from the truck driver. Lots more chasing, with David crashing into stuff and trying to lose the truck. David once again builds speed, hoping the incline will prevent the truck from keeping up. It works, but that's when a radiator hose breaks, sort of a Chekhov's radiator hose, as the first mechanic he encountered asked if he wanted it fixed, and David said no. The hose problem causes David to slow down, then at the top of the incline go into neutral to let gravity do the work with a car he can barely control, and he eventually does crash into a cliff. Just as the truck catches up, David is able to get his car driving again, which I don't understand, up a hill with a dead end. David appears to want to take the truck head on, but he's got a plan. He lodges his briefcase onto the gas pedal and jumps out of the car, and the truck smashes into it, unable to see the dead end that's approaching. The truck then tumbles off the cliff, and it goes down in the sound that Spielberg later would use in Jaws for the shark death. And ABC probably puts in a commercial break here so that it can return you to the very final moments of David cheering on his victory from above. You're expecting the truck to explode, but it does not. And that's the movie.
Damn it. One of my big notes I wanted to get out is I can't believe we've been staring at the word flammable all movie long and this truck doesn't explode.
Yeah,
that is such a tease.
That was the big studio note as well, apparently. And Spielberg said it was very important to him that the truck died like a wounded animal and not in an explosion. So I actually think the studio may have been right in this case because of the word flammable being on the truck, like you said, Jeremy.
Yeah,
but,
if it wasn't a flammable truck, I have no problem.
This is one of those cases where I kind of, you know, I get what you're saying, Spielberg. Like, I get the metaphor you're going for here, but... Yeah. I love this movie. I have seen it fairly recently for the first time and then rewatching it again for the show. And I think what stands out to me the most while watching this movie is how already Spielberg knew how to thematically tie a movie together and was so intent about how his shooting and his character work and everything worked towards the same goal. And in this case, it has to do with toxic masculinity. It has to do with being bullied. I think Spielberg has talked about that this is a representation of how he grew up feeling like he was bullied and how he saw his dad bullied and those kind of things. I identify this with this, you know, really well as a pacifistic man, as a man who has never gotten into fixing cars or grilling out or, you know, whatever the things that, you know, men are supposed to do. so like there's this, any names, you know, the character's name is Man. I mean, it you know, all the text is right there, but it's not just that the text is there. The subtext is so beautifully there as well. Like with every choice that's made, whether it be, you know, the not being able to control the kids who are being crazy, and then the other guy just gives them a stern voice and, you know, they do what they're supposed to do, whether it be his car not being enough to push the bus, but, you know, the big, you know, truck is enough. Even in when we approach the bus, there's all these kids standing there outside the bus, and two boys are just wrestling, you know, they're just fighting or whatever. And that's, I guarantee that's intentional. That Spielberg was like, we need bullying happening, you know, here in the shot as they are approaching. It's in the radio stuff at the very beginning. There's a whole prank call in the intro that's about, can I really be the man of the, can I tell the census I'm the man of the house if my woman is the one that goes to work and does all those things? Like, it's just threaded through the entire thing, and it's just, it's brilliant. I also wrote down, and this is complicated by the fact that this was actually shot after the TV movie, but I also wrote down, like, the courage of a 24-year-old filmmaker to be like, you know what we're starting with? Just 4 minutes of a point of view from a car, you know?
I'm telling you, man. Like, one of my notes I wrote down is, from the first minute, like, this movie is shot, like, you can just tell this is somebody who's got talent and it's going to take him somewhere.
Yeah.
And it's, like, the trust he has all movie long, in lack of dialogue. Like, I think the script has got to be like 20 pages max, right? Because there's almost, it's probably longer than that because there's a lot of description, but in terms of dialogue, there's so little. And he just lets what's happening play. And it's, yeah, it's confidence, clearly, that he probably has for good reason, because it's not like this is the first thing he ever filmed. But still, just, I was in awe of how this movie was shot.
Yeah, and the shot through the, you know, the washing machine door is really interesting in the way that it frames him. And again, framing him in a washing machine, women's work, like, you know, like there's this whole, you know, again, it just all feels very intentional and beautiful. And add to that, he just understands tension. He understands how to hold the audience where he needs them, you know, to do what he wants to do. So, Jeremy, I'll let you talk for a little bit and...
Well, I don't have anywhere near as poetic kind of verbiage. But no, this is my first viewing of this movie ever, and I'm really glad that you made it the big recommend. My one big question I kept asking the entire movie, almost to the end, is that at some point, do you not just go home? Do you not just turn around and go the opposite direction? Now, maybe the truck would still follow you. I don't know. The truck seems fairly omniscient. But, like, there was a point before it got really dangerous where I was like, well, you know, maybe pick a different road. Maybe turn around and go home and call Forbes and tell him you'll see him another day. Like, there seems to be, maybe this plays into the masculinity themes that he just refuses to give up when he's challenged. I don't know. But that was the one thing I kept thinking of. I was really, really excited to check out, knowing it was a chase kind of film, the continuity in all the angles and cuts of the film. And I'm here to tell you, other than the lines on the road, it's really fantastic. Like, there are times where it's a solid line and the next cut it's a dotted line, but other than that, the positions and speeds and relative locations of the truck and the car are almost always exactly where they need to be. And IMDb said they didn't storyboard. They made a huge aerial perspective map of the road that the car and truck travel along, and it took up four walls of his Palmdale motel room.
Yep.
And they marked it up like where the cameras would be, where the cars and the truck would be, and just, listen, this is why I know I don't want to direct a movie, because I do not have the patience to plan like that. Like, it is... there is an art, obviously, to it, and a beauty to the end result. But it is, there's a lot of math and planning and physics, and just I don't have that in me. This is why I like to write fiction, because I don't like to do research. but anyway, I think the planning that went into it is a feat in and of itself. I read that the truck apparently in real life never went more than 30 miles an hour. That's incredible. And he used apparently a camera rig that Bullitt used that was just 6 inches off the ground, which gives the illusion of more speed. But he also did some camera tricks and some perspective tricks. But there's so many scenes where I would promise you I thought that truck was actually going 60 miles an hour.
Well, that's things he said he did is he would try to get it where it was going past a cliff so that you could see the like stuff going by, basically.
And it was and looked like it was moving faster.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I love the Chuck's Cafe scene where we hear his thoughts as he works through all the possibilities. He's trying to rationalize in the beginning, like, you know, well, maybe it's okay. Maybe he's just having a bad day. Like, maybe he's just, like, he keeps throwing, he knows on some level that's not right, but he's trying to get himself to where this is not as harmful as it seems. I'm really frustrated he never eats that freaking sandwich because somebody who orders a Swiss cheese sandwich on rye, you'd think they like that because that is a really absurd sandwich and he never even touches it and it really bothers me. I love how he yells, "Hey, stop," to the truck that's actively trying to push him into a train.
Yep.
I love the Western elements here. And apparently Spielberg had said he was going for High Noon on wheels. And absolutely, you can see it in images. Like, there's literal tumbleweeds at one point, but then there's a couple of stare downs where you can almost hear that, even though it's not there. So, you know, you can really see the inspiration for a lot of the shots and the tension. I was going to knock the movie early on for how often he turns around and looks behind and it doesn't affect his driving. But then by the end of the movie, it happens several times where he almost veers off the road because he's looking behind. So again, Spielberg thought of everything. And I just want to say again, I'm pissed the truck doesn't explode, but that crash is awesome. Like,
yeah,
the fact that it goes on for as long as it does and all the crunching, and it's fantastic. It just doesn't explode.
Well, and apparently he had multiple cameras on the crash. He needed to have multiple cameras on several of these things because he had, you know, one thing that I found out during the thing that's on the Blu-ray is that he had 10 days to shoot this. He went over by 3 days for some extra things, but he had only that amount of time. This movie was basically going to air 3 months after he shot it. So he had to get it done fast. And the one thing, that crash had multiple cameras on it. And when they went into the editing room, it was that one that captured that whole descent down that he was like, we can't cut anywhere else. This is the best shot and this is the best way to end it. And so we're going to use this shot. So it was pretty freaking awesome on all this. Yeah, I love a lot of the stuff about that cafe thing. Of course, there's an unbroken shot basically of him going in, walking into the bathroom, and coming back and seeing the truck and everything. But the whole thing with him watching people go out, and he thinks maybe that's the truck driver. And of course, there's the one guy who goes behind the truck, and he drives off in another truck that's unseen.
Yep.
It reminds me a lot of Jaws when Roy Scheider is looking out to the water and he's looking for the shark, and it's just like people playing, like, oh no, that might be the shark. Oh no, it's just somebody in the water splashing around, or, you know, that type of thing. You can see a lot of Jaws in this movie, which is funny. We sit here and go, man, Spielberg really knew what he was doing on this movie, and he nearly got fired on Jaws because he didn't know what he was doing. And so, like, it just goes to show, you know, there's a lot of things that go into movies sometimes, and even if you have some success under your belt, you might still screw some things up. But I like these little touches too. I like the second gas station he goes to, and the one woman is like, "What would you like?" And he's like, "Do you have a telephone?" And she's clearly disappointed. He's like, "I got one around back. Do you want anything on your car?" And he goes, "I guess fill it up with some ethyl and fit to wherever point you can get." And she goes, "All righty." She just all of a sudden changes her tone completely. It's like, how in the world did she turn that into a memorable character? And by the way, she ends up in 1941 later on, that character, the gas station, the second gas station owner, like Belushi comes in flying a plane and asks for Ethel in his plane. So she shows up in that later. But yeah, one of the other things that Spielberg did in this movie that helped him save time, because he had such a big, huge time crunch, is that he would shoot a section of road And he would have basically, he would just shoot it, you know, with, you know, that camera thing from Bullet that you were talking about, Jeremy. And he had all the different angles and inside the cars and everything. And he'd shoot a lot of stuff just on this one stretch of road. And then they would turn it around and he would go the opposite way so that they could get all of that. It would look like they're still on the same road, but it would look like they've gone further down, but right. They're just on the opposite end and everything. So that was another thing that he did on this. But yeah, I really thought I watching this movie a long time ago, I wasn't thinking about manhood or anything like that, but all the things sort of like clue you into it. The radio stuff at the beginning, and then the sort of like, what do you do about this? This is a problem that you can't confront, that you can't escape from. So what is it? What is the solution? That's what it's a real feeling of helplessness in this, because he's ready to confront this, but he can't just go. He can't like knock this truck off the road or anything like that. Although someone in chat was like, maybe he should have gone out and slashed this dude's tires before he left. Yeah, that's one option, I guess. If you've gone over the limit. He hadn't gone over the limit yet at this point, though. He's still trying to play nice, and he realizes that nice isn't going to get it in the end. But yeah, I really, really, really love this movie, and I'm glad to have revisited it.
Well, there's sorry, I just remembered. I don't think any of us have talked about it yet. There's even when he calls his wife, there's this story about the night before they were at a gathering and some guy, she says, practically raped her. And he apparently didn't stand up for her. And she's mad at him about that, which is just another thing early along that sets that tone and theme. But the more you reflect on it, the more it's very cohesive. It's very tied together.
Well, even the bus thing is a whole thing on his like masculinity, because he can't push that car. He doesn't have a big enough car. If you want to start doing the big dick comparisons here, this is the thing here where he's trying to push the car. He doesn't have a big enough car. And then the guy who's been an asshole to him the entire movie goes over there and solves the problem for him, which is an even more damning statement on his masculinity than almost anything else in this movie.
Yeah.
It feels like that the guy who was the dick comes in and solves the problem. So yeah.
Well, and there's the radiator hose thing, which is also this very, again, I mentioned, you know, not being a car guy, like, you know, he says something like, where have I heard that before? Because that is one of those things where, like, I find myself in with mechanics or anybody where I'm like, I don't know if you're just like, yeah, I could charge $100 to put a new one of these in because I could, or if it really needs it, or, you know, those kind of things. And then of course he actually does need it later, and it's just, you know, all that stuff.
It's like Costanza on Seinfeld, where he's talking about not trusting mechanics, and he's like, well, you need a new Johnson rod. And I'm like, well, that better get that. Don't want to do it on my Johnson rod.
The other thing about the ending that I found interesting in some of the research was that they, like you said, Chris, they only had one take on this. Like, they knew they were only going to get to do this once. And they literally, the driver had to bail out of that truck before it went over. That was a driven truck that he had to bail out of. And he tried to shut the passenger door on the way back, and it didn't shut. So if you watch that shot, the driver door is wide open as it's like, you know, coming down there. And so Spielberg shot some extra like blood on a steering wheel to insert there, so people knew the driver didn't escape. Like, he didn't want people being like, oh, see that door open right there? You know what that means? That means he's still alive.
Here comes a sequel.
Yeah, they were definitely thinking sequels back in the day in the 1970s, in the early 1970s, you know. All right, let's get on to our super secret double feature.
Between client meetings, managing your business, and everyday tasks, who has time to worry about website hosting? With Kinsta's managed WordPress hosting, you don't have to. They handle the technical stuff, delivering lightning-fast load times, enterprise-grade security, and 24/7, 365 human-only support. Simply switching to Kinsta could make your site up to 200% faster. Kinsta's custom dashboard makes managing sites easy, with powerful features designed to save you time and effort. Plus, their free expert-led migrations ensure a smooth transition. Ready to see why Kinsta is trusted by thousands of businesses? Get your first month free at Kinsta.com. That's KINSTA.com. Kinsta, simply better hosting.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With a message for everyone paying big wireless way too much. Please, for the love of everything good in this world, stop. With Mint, you can get premium wireless for just $15 a month. Of course, if you enjoy overpaying, no judgments, but that's weird. Okay, one judgment. Anyway, give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan, equivalent to $15 per month required. Intro rate first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See full terms at mintmobile.com.
Looking to buy your dream home or rent that perfect apartment? With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Set up your gotta-have-it wish list, and Redfin will send you real-time notifications for properties that match. And when you're ready to see it in person, scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Thinking about selling? Redfin can do that too. In fact, Redfin agents close twice as many deals as other agents, so they know how to get the best price for your home. And with a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin charges half of what others often charge. So you could save big, like really big. Last year, Redfin saved home sellers $118 million. So whether you're buying, renting, or selling, Redfin's ready to help you win. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
And Jeremy, what did you think?
Oh man, you're gonna make me go first after last week.
Yes, of
Dicer,
course.
What do you think?
No, I want him to steal mine. Let's go.
All right. Well, there are, I think, a good handful of super on-the-nose double features that would be really, really good to pair with this movie. I'm not going to name any of them in case Aaron has chosen one of them. I went a little... Now, I did go... I had a couple wild choices. After Aaron goes, I'll tell you one of my wild choices. But where I ended up settling was Jeepers Creepers. Now, the caveat here is that the guy who made this movie is a very bad person, but he was the director. He was, you know, the writer, the actors, cinematographer, everybody else who worked on this movie is not a bad person, to my knowledge. But the reason I went with this movie is both the relentlessness of the pursuit and the fact that the truck itself is almost a character. For about half of Jeepers Creepers, that truck is a jump scare. That truck is, there's even a shot in broad daylight when the headlights come up over the hill in the distance, and it's like scary as crap. So the way that this movie keeps cutting to the truck, we never even see the driver except for his arm. So I just think that would be an interesting double feature to pair. Jeepers Creepers.
I don't remember everything about Jeepers Creepers, but I thought what you're describing sounded like Joyride more to me than I don't remember the truck in Jeepers Creepers, but I
it's been forever.
The beginning of the movie, it's basically the beginning of Duel. They pull up on the truck and they try to pass it, and then the truck torments them, and it's basically Duel for the first 20
minutes.
It's
a beat up old
ever since I've seen Jeepers
Creepers.
Yeah, it's a beat up old farm truck. You and I saw that movie. The night before it opened.
Was it a double feature with O that same night?
It was. That was a wild night. I do think if you go back to Jeepers Creepers, you'll see there's a lot of similar kind of cuts. I wouldn't even be surprised if it was inspired in many ways, some of the shots by Duel.
Probably was.
But that is my SSDF. Aaron, what do you got?
Boy, did I want to go with Breakdown on this. I think it's one of those, you know, kind of more on the nose picks.
Who are you calling a moron?
Yes. You know, more on the nose. He's a gambler. But I ended up going with Invisible Man. Speaking of
nice.
I think there's some real interesting parallels here with an unseen pursuer that work really well, and the helplessness, that there is in a situation where all the control is elsewhere. And it deals with the other side of toxic masculinity, you know, as mm-hmm. far as towards women and not other men. Mm-hmm. So in the ways that presents differently generally when dealing with the way men enact toxic masculinity on women versus men. So yeah, that went with
fascinating.
Invisible Man.
It's funny that, you know, as I started watching Duel and I started thinking about Breakdown as well, I was like, man, I must really have a thing for asshole driver, truck driver movies where, you know, they put the everyman in danger doing some, trying to get somewhere or whatever. But, it would go along well with Breakdown, but I like you guys' off-kilter ones.
The one I almost wanted to go with was Predator, and I thought that was just a little too out there, but now that Aaron's gone Invisible Man, maybe I could have gone Predator. I think there's a connection there, maybe, but I still like Jeepers Creepers there, just for the truck.
Or the Terminator, you know, you just like man versus machine, man.
You could even go Halloween, like the truck almost feels like Mike Myers in some ways, you know, like this just you know, pursuer.
All right.
Good stuff. All good right. stuff.
He couldn't see me. all right. All right. What? I believe Jeremy's turn next week. What is the homework for next week? What are the movie? What are we going to watch next week?
Next week, we're going to watch a movie that I have seen a few times. From 2007, called Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. This is Philip Seymour Hoffman and Ethan Hawke. They are the sons, they're brothers. They're sons of Albert Finney and Rosemary Harris. That's Aunt May. The parents own a jewelry store. And one or more of the sons or acquaintances decide to rob said store. This movie is completely presented out of sequence. You're going to jump back and forth in time several times as we follow different people through the same events, almost Rashomon style. But Philip Seymour Hoffman is incredible in this movie. It's a Sidney Lumet, not sure how to pronounce this name. Lumet. And it's an 89 on Rotten Tomatoes, so I think the critics generally love it. Now, this movie is everywhere. It's free on Philo, Peacock, Tubi, Pluto, Roku, Crackle, Plex, and then if you have Hulu or Amazon, it's on there as well.
and it also has the other Aunt May in it too, right? Marissa Tomei?
Yes, Marissa Tomei is also in it, yeah. I didn't even make that connection. That's wild.
Like, if they could have just gotten Sally Field, we could have made a triumvirate there.
That's funny.
So, yeah. All right, cool. I haven't seen this movie since it came out, so I'll be happy to revisit this one for sure.
And I've never seen it, so this will be my first time.
Even better. Nice. This is a really good one, so... this might have been Lumet's last movie. I don't know. He died sometime close to this, I believe.
He died in 2011, and this came out in 2007. So let's see if he has anything that came out of this. My internet is as fast as I can pay for, and it's never fast enough. It's always slow. Poor Devil's Your Debt was his last movie.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Man, yes.
74 directing credits.
This will be our second one of his too. I believe we did 12 Angry Men.
Yes.
Not too long ago either. So we're collecting some Lumets here.
Yeah.
Jonathan will be pleased. all right. Looks like we have some time for some questions.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I'm listening.
Questions. What's your favorite movie MacGuffin?
Mine, I just went with The Body of David in Rope, which is the movie's primary plot driver. But we never really get a sense for who David is, or, like, you know, motivation is so... not the point in that movie. In fact, it's the anti-point, that, you know, it's really all about the philosophical conversation. So that's what I went with.
Awesome. What about you, Jeremy?
Well, I wrote an answer down that I'm reading it. I don't like that. It's not good. It's not good. It's not good. So I'm just going to go with the most recent one. It's not my favorite. It's just the most recent MacGuffin. Literally the most recent MacGuffin I've seen, and it's the Codex in Venom: The Last Stand, which I found to be a very confusing and pointless piece of let's get everybody where we want them whenever we want them there. And as somebody who unabashedly loved the first two Venom movies, I didn't have a good time here. I was disappointed. Mm. But the Codex is just, it might as well have literally called it a MacGuffin.
Yeah. I went with The School Bomb and Die Hard with a Vengeance.
Oh, nice.
It's definitely something that, you know, has everybody scattered and looking for it. Now, it may not completely and totally fit the model of what the MacGuffin is, because it only turns out to be not a bomb at the end. Like, if it really was, then I guess it no longer is a MacGuffin. But the fact is that since it's just it's something that gets everybody moving, and so that he can go and rob the Federal Reserve and everything, it just sort of becomes a MacGuffin. Mm. So anyway, going over to the chat. By the way, Inked Lilith says, no question, just want to say y'all are super dope. I love everything you do.
Awesome. Well,
thank you. Thank you so much. That makes me feel good. Let's see. Josh says, Da Vinci Code series movies have some pretty good MacGuffins. Nolan says, the Maltese Falcon is the OG on that. Mm. Man, that's been forever since I've seen the Maltese Falcon. Me too. I need to revisit that movie. Yeah, Castro says the special piece in the Lego movie.
Oh, the piece of resistance.
Yes. Yes. And ShaggyNet says Arlington Road, which I think is a sort of a reference to what I was talking about in Die Hard, the fake bomb, mm-hmm. basically. And Polly says, in Back to the Future, is the future a MacGuffin? Ooh. I think it is.
Conan?
The future?
I got. Let's see. Let's do one more question at least here. Who are two actors you confuse when you see their names?
Mm.
For me, it's Parker Posey and Piper Perabo. And don't say Bill Paxton and Bill Pullman. Everyone does that. Okay, we won't say that.
Fine,
then.
Steal it.
Yeah, exactly. What do you think? What do you guys think? Jeremy, what do you think?
Well, again, like I wrote these answers like a month ago. I don't like these answers. I was reading the wrong one. This is correct. This is the right one. Ty Sheridan and Taylor Sheridan.
yeah.
Are both actors. Now, Taylor Sheridan has moved more into creator, writer, director, Yellowstone and all of its spinoffs, the Stallone show, the Jeremy Renner show. But he is still an actor and started as an actor. And then Ty Sheridan is an actor and a writer, apparently. And he was in Ready Player One. But he also looks like Barry Keoghan. So when I see him next to Barry Keoghan, I get those two confused.
I get those guys confused a lot when I see them at first. I have to go through the whole he's in this movie. Okay, yeah, that's Ty Sheridan. Or, you know, like, I also have a director confusion, and it's mainly just their names. When I hear Gareth Edwards and Gareth Evans, I always have to sort of run a program in my head to figure out which one of these guys did Godzilla and which one of these guys did The Raid. And then there's a classic one, and I feel bad that I always run through this, and I know this is a running joke, and it's very much like the Paxton Pullman thing, but Dermot Mulroney and Dylan McDermott. Always gets me going into that thing. I'm good these days when hearing the name, picturing the right person, but there was a time where it was really, really tough for me to, like, when you said any of those names, me coming up with the right person immediately. And those names, how are those names that close? And they came up at about the same time too. So anyway,
I've got a really weird one, and I think it probably is just me. I get Michael Douglas and Kurt Russell confused. And the reason I think is my brain is trying to do the math of, oh, who is that on the screen? Oh, that's, Michael Douglas, Kurt Russell. But then I've got Kirk Douglas in my brain too. And so there's of course, two of them are, related. I don't know. So like the Douglas and the Kurtz and the Kirks and it all jumbles up in my brain. And I'm just like, who was in the computer who wore tennis shoes? I don't know.
Then you throw in Michael Keaton, whose real name originally was Michael Douglas, but he couldn't use that in Hollywood because there was another Michael Douglas.
Who knows?
That's correct. Looking over at the chat, Josh says Terrence Howard and Terrence Malick. Not that Malick is an actor, but yeah, the question is about names, so it makes a lot of sense. Nolan says Will Smith the actor and Will Smith the Dodgers catcher and Will Smith the pitcher. Yes, that is a good thing if you're into baseball.
Michael
and
Jackson
movies.
The pop star and Michael Jackson the kicker who kicked for a long time in the NFL.
Yes. There was a time where if you went to social media and you'd see something like Will Smith trending, you'd be like, which Will Smith? There's a whole bunch of stuff going on. Polly says the Sarsgaard and Skarsgård gets me. It gets us all, man. It gets us all. I think I don't know what it is that I do to sort of correct myself when I see those names, but like I have probably said Peter Skarsgård and Stellan Skarsgård several times over my life, and it always, and it's amazing. Like how are the, you like they've got to have some relation somewhere. Like you go further up you go back in time. There's got to be some sort of connection between those guys, right? Nolan says Ansel Elgort and Taron Egerton. Yeah. Mm. I would say probably more looks wise than name wise. Is what I'm gonna say. Nolan, who his last name is McDermott, says McDermott, you say. let's see. Tatsu says, for the longest time I thought Rain Wilson was Hank Azaria. Then I finally saw what Hank Azaria actually looks like. Casher says Ed Helms and Ed Harris. Josh says, I also confuse Amy Adams and Rachel McAdams. Then Shaggy has Michael B. Jordan on there. Yeah, that's the reason why they put the B in his name. So
Is Topher Grace and Tobey Maguire a confused one a bit? That one messes with me sometimes, too. I don't know why.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Both in Spider-Man 3.
That's true.
One of them was a heavy poker player, and the other one played a poker player in Ocean's 11. See? Actually, he was playing himself.
That was a lightning quick connection. I love it, Jeremy. Yeah. Oh, my God. That
my synapses are firing, baby.
Yeah. That's right. All right. That's going to do it for this week. Thank you guys so much in chat for coming out today. We appreciate it. Next week is Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. And I can't wait to look at that again, but that's going to do it for this week. We will see you next time.
Bye. See you guys.
Bye.
Thanks for coming out.
Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Our kids are getting to the age where we just don't do birthdays like we used to. Like, they're older now, and so like they kind of evolve out of like, all the, let's throw a party and get you a little toy. So now they just like text us an Amazon wish list. That's basically happy birthday these days. All right, cool. Cat's in the Cradle.
Yeah. I don't know what that song means, except that it's dads and sons, and it made that guy cry.
It's true. Well, then you know what it means.
Oh. For me, the song would be The Leader of the Band. You know that song?
Leader of the Band, no.
The leader of the band is tired, and his eyes are growing old. but his blood runs through his instrument, and his blood something's in my soul. Imitate the man. I'm just a living legacy to the leader of the band. Anyway, that's my father's son song.
Oh.
It's got a nice little trumpet part. Anyway, look it up. I was just blowing my wife's mind with the birthday paradox.
Oh, yeah. We have a couple of real life examples of that. You know, there's a group of four families that get together in vacation each year. I've talked about it before, but we, you know, we and three other families, there are four birthdays on the same day.
Wow.
In those four families.
Well, and CinemaSins, three out of seven people have the same birthday.
Yeah.
Which is absurd, beyond the math of the birthday paradoxes.
Correct. The same? I thought there was only two.
Aaron, Jonathan, and Ian all have the same
May 26th.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought you were including yourself, because I knew you had a different one from Jonathan. I didn't know Ian was the same as two other people. I didn't know that.
Yeah, three on the same day, four in the same month. Anyway.
Yeah.
It's just what I love about that, when people haven't heard of it and you explain it to them, it's just that when you hear it, you absorb it in the first person. So you're thinking, one of these other 23 people in this room has my birthday, and there's no way the odds are that good. But it's actually any two of the people out of 23.
There's an old poker player who used to go around in the 80s or whatever to parties and make that bet with people who didn't know about the thing. Nice. It's like, I bet there's someone in this room that has the same birthday. I don't know. I think they'd left it to, there's two people here who have the same birthday, and it's always something like 15 people in there or whatever. And it's like, no way. And then he would win, obviously, a lot. Because
well, yeah, because your human brain goes, no, it would take, you know, over 350 people before we'd have, you know, the same birthday or whatever. And it's like, no, that's not exactly how probabilities work, but
no, it's wild. It's fascinating.
Can I rant about a movie we probably won't talk about on the show? Unless you've seen Wolfman. Have you seen Wolfman, Chris?
I haven't.
All right. So, and Jeremy, I'm assuming you haven't seen it either.
I haven't, but I'm really upset with all the reviews I've read.
I think it's kind of terrible, but it's stylistically cool, and Lee Winnell knows what he's doing with a camera, but it's just, for me, and I don't think this is spoiling too much, but it takes everything that I thought the character, like the Wolfman monster, symbolized about like masculinity and about like, you know, this other part of us that comes out and then is gone. And it's like, what is real? What, you know, what isn't? Who is the real you kind of thing? And it changes the mythology in such a drastic way that just is gone. Like, it's like, and I think he wanted to make a point about like permanence of like passed on toxic masculinity, but that's so, I don't know. It really messed me up. I watched the movie and I was just like, I mean, it's also kind of boring, which for a horror movie, that's never a good sign, but there's just not a lot of tension in it. But yeah, I was just like, that's you, like with Invisible Man, you made the point of that villain so crystal clear with, you know, how that villain works and about gaslighting, and it's perfect. Invisible Man is a perfect metaphor for gaslighting. And it's like Lee Winnell or whoever wrote the story. Did Lee write the movie too? I don't know.
I'm not sure about that.
Whoever wrote the story just, to me, misunderstood what the Wolfman was all about. And so that's kind of, I think Teen Wolf has a better understanding of the metaphor of the Wolfman than Wolfman does. So
wow.
It looks like he co-wrote it with somebody named Cooper. What is his name?
Cooper Cup?
Corbett Tuck.
Okay.
But he also, and so and he also, but he didn't co-write Invisible Man with anybody. Corbett Tuck. Oh, looks like this is the connection between she and Winnell, is that she worked on Insidious, but she was an actress on that. But I would hate to say that she's the problem, because who knows?
Yeah, well, there can be many things that are the problem.
There's a number of things. That's why I have a hard time sometimes blaming writers for anything, because they get their shit changed all the time.
Sure. Like, or actors, for that matter, because they do 12 takes and it's up to the director which one to take. It's hard to blame anybody for anything, really.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But who knows in this case what happened? I mean, a lot of times you get a successful movie, you have everything perfect and everything, and then the studios want to meddle and do some things, or you had a direction and it didn't work.
Here's the thing. How many good Wolfman movies have we had?
I mean, some would say just the Benicio del Toro one, and even that's probably debatable, but...
Ooh, no. Ooh.
Yeah, I don't like that one. And didn't they just announce last week Robert Eggers is going to make a werewolf movie now?
Yeah, he did.
What are we doing?
Somebody needs to get it right eventually.
I would have imagined that the original Wolfman would have been one that people brought up. Although... I haven't seen that original one in a long time. I think it was 1940 when it came out, something like that. I don't remember liking that one either. So
I mean, it's like that Seinfeld bit about the location in town where nobody can do business in this location. Everything that opens in there closes. Like, nobody can make a Wolfman movie. Everybody that tries fails. Let's stop
American
trying.
American Werewolf in London might be the
last. That's probably it, yeah. Speaking of Lee Whannell. I on Saturday watched 6 Saw movies. Thank you very much.
What the hell, dude?
I think when I watched The Human Centipede, I think that unlocked something, because it's so ridiculous and so dumb that now these movies that kind of trade in gore as kind of one of the primary factors just seems silly. Just the gore seems a little silly to me. It doesn't gross me out anymore. So there's a little bit of positive desensitization, I guess, to the gore aspect. And once you get past that in the Saw movies, those could have been really good. There's a really interesting seed of the core character, the Jigsaw character, about thinking he's not a murderer. Even though he lets people die, he says it's there's a really interesting seed of redemption and the road to hell is paved in good intention. There's some really interesting stuff in there, but everybody in those movies is so dumb. They just make all the dumb choices every time. It's annoying.
I can't remember which one it is now at this point. Was it Saw? It might have been Part 2 or 4. I think it was one of the even ones, because I remember there being a thing where I liked the odd ones, but then the even ones sucked, and I can't remember.
Two is an escape room.
What it is. That's it's all the people that are in that that keep going into these different rooms, and so. It to me, it's you've been introduced to what kind of world you're in. First room. You know what kind of world you're in, and then this is what you're talking about. They'll go into another room and pretend none of that ever happened before. So there's this one where I believe it. Yeah. So it has to be Saw 2, where there's a bowl with a key in it, and this girl goes in to get the key, and it's oh, there's a key. And she just puts her hands in the bowl without even thinking that it could be a problem. And I instantly switched off when I saw that movie. I was just man, I hate it when movies tell the characters this is what you're in, and then they forget about it. I hate that.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's escape room culture that has changed this. I don't remember if escape rooms were a big deal when Saw 2 came out, but the easiest solve in the world is that movie. I get, Jeremy, do you care if I spoil Saw 2? If you do and you're listening, then maybe this is your last outtake. But on the tape at the very beginning, he says the answer is at the back of your minds, and you'll know the order because it's over the rainbow or whatever. And it's who doesn't just look at the back of people's heads at that point? Mm-hmm. Like, it's so dumb in like that they all, you know, none of them were like, hey, can I check out the back of your head and see if maybe there's like a number on there? Mm-hmm. Oh, is that number a color? Maybe that relates to the rain. But like, it was the easiest solve in, I don't know. Again, maybe maybe escape room culture has changed puzzles in a way, but like, I don't know.
I feel like annoying. I've never done an escape room, but I feel like I would massively overthink it. Like the fun ones, for not like the murder ones in the movies, but like I think I would massively overthink it because there's probably like a three levels down solution, and I would be like on level 12 going, no, this little scratch over here is pointing at this little thing over here. Like that's just the way my brain works. I look for the most complicated.
I think the problem for movies is trying to get a worthwhile puzzle that everybody can solve and try to condense that into something fast enough for a movie. And a lot of times these puzzles end up just being like really basic and like really like they don't activate your mind at all, really, because they're just very, 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 very simple. And and that's what I always come away being disappointed by, is that it's like, oh, the solution is really pretty easy or whatever. Like, you know, although there are some pretty, I mean, Saw 3, I think, is it Saw 3? See, again, now I don't know anymore.
If you tell me one of the traps, I could probably tell you which movie.
Well,
at this point.
So you got to look at them as two movies, because one is happening while the other is happening. So you have the one where Angus McFadden is trying to go find his wife in this thing, and then you find out that like that was happening at the same time as the one with Donnie Wahlberg.
Mm-hmm.
In I can't remember which ones they were, but.
Donnie Wahlberg was two, and then three was McFadden's.
Okay, so two has that pretty fun thing where Jigsaw tells him that, you know, it basically tells him his son's right here. You just have to listen to him or whatever.
Yes,
and he Donnie Wahlberg's such a dumb, aggressive asshole that he doesn't listen to anything. But then three happens, and that's happening at the same time as two is or whatever, and it's kind of got some interesting stuff there. But
well, that's what I'm saying. Like, there is some really interesting stuff, I think, in the original trilogy. I think the first three hold some really interesting ideas. Then I think it just becomes, let's try to create a gross trap and then also try to retcon new Saw killers. Like,
that's the thing, they try to if you watched the next Saw's going, but I thought they had a chance to get out. I thought that was the whole point. And they're like, it was because somebody
else
underneath Jigsaw.
Yeah.
Yeah. Underneath Jigsaw decided to go on their own route. And see, that's fun, because you're like, the fun of Saw has always been they could get out of the traps. Not I'm going to find out three movies later that, you know, oh, it was somebody who was a dick the whole time that was doing it.
It's so much less fun.
I mean, why would you do that? It's not like these are wrong turns. Like,
maybe
he's
they
got
are,
nothing
though.
On wrong turn.
That should be my next deep dive. I'll do all the wrong turn movies next Saturday.
Oh, you're gonna lose so much respect for me.
Oh, Corbett Tuck is married to Lee Whannell. That's the reason why. Oh, okay, I get it. That's for the outtakes, guys. That's for the outtakes.
At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger, and you can get started now by saving when you join today. We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need, and you can work out your way on your time at any convenient location near you. Most open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save. Just $1 down, $15 a month. See Home Club for details.